Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Yeah, we're off. Hello, welcome to. Oh God, welcome to another edition of Fan Club. Never ever introduced it like that.
Now I feel thrown. I feel thrown by the introduction.
You're listening to Fun Size Family Five Star Fan Club, and we are your hosts. My name is Nick Helm, and I'm joined ably by
Nathaniel Metcalf
on the decks. The wheels of steel. Here's a question: is it muggy today?
Oh, do you know what? It is muggy. I've just realised quite how muggy it is. I think I've got quite a muggy room.
Right, yeah. I can't tell whether I've got COVID or whether it's just inclement weather.
Sure. Well, I did see you yesterday, so we might have both have COVID.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Might have passed it to each other. That was my first time out yesterday. Went to the pub with you, Nick. That was the first time in a pub.
It was
all right, wasn't it?
It was absolutely fine.
Lovely company.
Say again?
Lovely company.
It was fine. No, great. But it is a bit of a problem because we did basically do our weekly podcast at a pub table and... we didn't record it, so now we're here today.
Fine, this is fine.
We've got to re-bottle lightning. First rule of Fan Club is tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club is please, for the love of God, tell your friends. It's a bit of a weird one. So today we're recording on a Monday, even though it's going to be broadcast on a Friday, because Nathaniel has to go back to work. And so we basically had, this is the shortest distance between shows that we've had, I think. So, we've only had a couple of days where we have it. So basically, yeah, it is our second show.
We basically had 2 days away from each other, which we ruined by seeing each other yesterday.
Yeah. And now it's like, so get ready, strap yourselves in for some weak sauce chat. Having said that, I watched Evil Dead 2 last night.
Well done.
Because we were talking about Bruce Campbell yesterday, I thought, do you know what? Do you know what I haven't seen in 3 weeks? Evil Dead 2. So I watched Evil Dead 2. It's the first time it's ever occurred to me, right? I know the first 5 minutes is a recap, right, of Evil Dead 1, right? I get that, right? But within the first 5 minutes... So his girlfriend gets possessed by an evil spirit. She goes off into the woods. She comes out and she attacks him. And in self-defense, he grabs a shovel and decapitates her, right? Now, he must, at that point, still be trying to work out what's going on, you know? He's like, well, bloody hell, she suddenly got possessed by an evil spirit. God knows what got into her, right? So he digs a shallow grave and buries her. He's got a car. Why doesn't he just, like, when you watch it, you just go, why hasn't he just loaded her into the car? Why is he, what's he planning on doing? Just spending the rest of the night in the cabin anyway? Do you know what I mean? It's just like, I've killed my girlfriend.
Yeah.
So he's just like, well, I'll dig the body, because I'm pretty sure that her parents and her family and all of her friends, either they won't have any questions or they'll be happy for me to just do the ceremony all by myself the minute she's dead while she's still warm.
And if they ask, they just go, she's somewhere over there.
I put a little cross in the ground for her. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of like, he doesn't even think about it. He's killed her, and his very first decision is, oh, well, I'll just dig a shallow grave, dispose of the body that way, and then I'm going to probably go to bed early, I think.
I tell you what, the film must be such a high-octane thrill, Nick, because how many times have you seen it without ever questioning it?
Probably over 7,000.
Yeah, and
I've never questioned it. I've never questioned
it. That's probably a good thing then, right? They're doing something, right?
Well, probably, but it's fucking jarring when you actually realise. But what is also, I think that, so there's a lot of chat about, like, what's the better film, Evil Dead 2, or fan favourite, Army of Darkness. Evil Dead 2 is probably the better film. But I think one of the things that makes it, makes those two films, because we were talking about the El Mariachi trilogy the other week, and I watched Desperados and Once Upon a Time in Mexico under your recommendation. I mean, you were saying basically you shouldn't watch them back to back.
And you did, didn't you?
I did. Yes, I watched them straight back to back. Watched Desperados and then Once Upon a Time in Mexico, one a night. Yeah, there's some really good bits in Once Upon a Time in Mexico. My point really is the fact that it's a trilogy of films that is just absolutely completely disjointed. They, it barely hangs together as a trilogy, although I think the first and the second film work really well together. But as soon as you add the third one, because all three of them are so different, it retroactively makes the first one not really fit with the second one. Do you know what I mean? It's like, as a couple of films, they're great, El Mariachi and Desperados. But when you put Once Upon a Time in Mexico in, it's so different that it's kind of crazy. So I thought that about the Evil Dead films, really. Although I think it's a good trilogy, I think it works as a trilogy. But you've got Army of Darkness, which is so vastly different from Evil Dead that a lot of the diehard horror fans found it disappointing. There's a lot more plot in it, for a start, because Evil Dead is literally Bruce Campbell in a cabin killing demons. Evil Dead 2, the same thing. And then Army of Darkness is a medieval adventure romp where he's fighting Ray Harryhausen skeletons. And, you know, it's totally different. But I think the main difference is 50%, maybe 60% of Evil Dead 2 is a silent movie. It's basically, it's like a Buster Keaton short. Everything works silent. Like, he'll occasionally say something, but he's on his own for most of the film. And whenever you go back to the Billy Joe and the other guys, you know, you've got the four guys that are coming to the cabin. Whenever you get to that, there's sort of like dialogue and they're chatting a bit, but those bits are always really boring to me. And then when you get back to the cabin, it's just Bruce Campbell it's like a silent performance, like all his facial expressions. He even makes his ear move at one point, you know, and you just think, oh my God, what a talent. He can even do ear acting, you know?
I'd say something interesting is that both Evil Dead 2 and Desperado both work as kind of sequels and remakes of the prequel.
Yeah. And I think that was it before Desperado? I think it was before Desperado. So based on El Mariachi, Robert Rodriguez requested to get the script for Evil Dead 2 so he could learn how to write an action film.
Oh, really? That makes sense.
So Evil Dead 2 was sort of like a really big influence on him for Desperado.
As it was huge, wasn't it, for all that kind of generation of non-film school-y directors?
It's huge, but also Evil Dead, I suppose, because Evil Dead 2 is like the one that's like, it was like, it was around that era, wasn't it, when you had Peter Jackson doing kind of like Brain Dead, and it was before Brain Dead, and it was one of those things, what do you call it, Splatstick, where it's like a slapstick horror movie, which is just, so it's genuinely funny, and it's sort of scary in places, and it's disgusting in places, and it's kind of, it's a lot of fun. Evil Dead 2, but Evil Dead 1 is one of those films, like, if it's kind of like, it was like 20 year old people making Evil Dead, and you can see all the seams, do you know what I mean? You see the shots, and you can, either you can work it out how they did the effects, or or, you know, you just read about it a little bit and you realise that, you know, when they do all of the deadite vision, when they're being chased through the woods, they basically just got a plank of wood and put taped a camera into the middle of the plank of wood, and then they got a guy at either end and they ran through the woods, and it sort of gave it like this steady cam thing because the camera was bang in the middle of the plank. And it's kind of like, it's so handmade and homemade that it's all, almost just like, if you just study Evil Dead, it's like a film school.
Mm.
And Joel Cohen did the sound editing on Evil Dead. And so when you see films like Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, which were like the like early Coen Brothers films, like Raising Arizona, there's shots in there that are exactly out of Evil Dead that... because it's like a, well, it's not really a romantic comedy, but because it's sort of like this broad sort of like...
Looney Tunes almost, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, family sort of like Looney Tunes comedy, Raising Arizona. They use all of these things that they used in sort of like Evil Dead, and they use it out of context. And so it's kind of like, it's just really weird. But then they use the exact same sort of like techniques on Blood Simple as well. And that's a, you know, a film noir. And so it's just kind of like, it's really interesting because they kind of like, they developed all of this stuff for like this hardcore horror movie, and you associate all of these angles. And then you can sort of like see the same filmmaking process from the Coen brothers early on in their career before they sort of like got their own style. But yeah, I mean, they were like really heavily influenced by Sam Raimi, because Sam Raimi was making films before the Coen brothers. And then, you know, Sam Raimi, it went cyclical where Sam Raimi ended up making... what's that? Simple Plan? Simple Plan, which is sort of like his Fargo. Mm.
Really good. Really good movie as well.
It's really good. Have you ever seen Crime Wave?
Yes, I have. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Awful film.
I remember quite liking it, but it was quite... yeah, it feels like a B-movie, doesn't it? It's got a very sort of...
I mean, it was another example of Sam Raimi wanting Bruce Campbell for the lead, and then the studio saying you can't have him as the lead. And so there's this other guy as the lead, and you've never heard of him again. And it's just kind of like, well, you know, Bruce Campbell has consistently popped up in films all this time. And there's like, there was like, I mean, this is like a recap of what we were talking about yesterday, but there's like three or four films that, you know, Darkman, they wanted him as the lead. He wasn't allowed to be the lead. Crime Wave, they wanted him as the lead. Wasn't allowed to be the lead. I'm sure there are others, but I was saying like one of the worst films that Bruce Campbell has ever appeared in is Congo. It's just this really terrible film, and the kind of the lead actor in that is fairly nondescript, and Bruce Campbell appears for like a 3-minute cameo right at the beginning of the film before he gets killed, and then the whole film is about trying to find him, and then at the end, I mean, I was gutted. This is a spoiler for Congo, by the way, but they spoiled it already.
Congo was a movie that even as, what year is Congo, 96?
Yeah, it was from the maker of Jurassic Park.
Yeah, so even as a 17-year-old, I was very aware going in that this wasn't going to be a primo movie, and that everything from the cast was telling me, Ernie Hudson, okay, Bruce Campbell, all right. It was all telling me,
Tim Curry,
not primo, a movie.
Yeah, but on the trailer, for, you know, there used to be kind of like movies, games and videos on a Saturday afternoon. And there was like an advert for Congo that came up, or like a TV spot. And just because the film is so boring, they had to use like a shot of Bruce Campbell screaming at the camera as kind of like a gorilla is attacking him, right? So you have Bruce Campbell turning to the camera and going, ah! And they used that in the trailer. And I was just like, that's fucking Bruce Campbell, right? And then you load your family up in the car and you go, right, we're going to go to the cinema. We're going to watch Bruce Campbell. So as a Bruce Campbell fan, when you're kind of like, you know, films are few and far between, and to actually get the opportunity to go to the cinema. I mean, I can't remember if it was before. I think it was before Escape from LA, which again...
That's the other one.
Which again was this sort of like, you go to the cinema because Bruce, you know, you're checking out IMDb and it's kind of like, oh my God, you know, Bruce Campbell's in Escape from LA, you know, it's kind of like, I don't think even we probably had IMDb, Yeah, I don't think I had IMDb then. So it's sort of like you're counting down the weeks for Escape from LA to come out because Bruce Campbell's in it, and then you come and see it. He's in it for 2 minutes, gets killed, and you go, all right, okay.
That was another one. I remember seeing that. I think in Flicks magazine, the free magazine you used to get in cinemas,
yeah,
you would have Escape from LA, and you go, wow, I've done an Escape from New York sequel. King Kurt's back, Kurt Russell. You've got Steve Buscemi and Bruce Campbell. Brilliant. Can't fail. Mm. Cannot fail.
Yeah, amazing cast. And John Carpenter, you know.
He's back.
And absolutely rubbish. I think Flicks magazine was when I first heard of Army of Darkness, of Evil Dead 3. I think it was called Medieval Dead then. Like, mm. It was like a preview of upcoming films. And there was a picture of Bruce Campbell in the daylight, and he's sort of like, he's probably sat on his horse and he's turned into the wise man and he's telling him he's an idiot, right? And that's the shot that they used. And I remember like reading about it and thinking that sounded dead scary because I got Evil Dead films mixed up with Night of the Living Dead films, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Evil Dead, The Return of the Living Dead. I like clumped them all in together. And I think I probably thought Army of Darkness or Medieval Dead was like Return of the Living Dead 3. So I was scared of it long before I saw it. Say again?
I think I did the same thing. I think Return of the Living Dead was exactly the same franchise as Night of the Living Dead when I was a kid. Must be yeah. The same thing.
Yeah, but also Return of the Living Dead is sort of is the same franchise as Night of the Living Dead because it's based on the fact that Night of the Living Dead is a film that's based on a true event, and then Return of the Living Dead is kind of like going, but this is what really happened, you know. So they are sort of, there is sort of like connective tissue, but like Dan O'Bannon is basically Return of the Living Dead, which is a great film. I think Return of the Living Dead is a really brilliant film. Sequel's not as good. And then the third one is kind of like, it's just a zombie movie that's basically got nothing to do with the first two. But they do like that weird thing where, that Robert Rodriguez does in Desperado, where he gets the same cast back for the sequel, but they're playing different characters.
Yes, yeah.
And it's kind of like, but for the Return of the Living Dead, it's kind of like, it's a bit of an odd thing. And it's just not as good. All it does is it highlights how it's not as good as the first one.
The nice thing about, like you were saying, Histi, about Desperado, is that he does basically get the whole of the cast of the first one back. And because he makes a thing in all his films about having characters return playing different parts, he can even still manage to have the lead from El Mariachi in the sequel without it having to just be replaced by Antonio Banderas.
And he's almost the coolest character.
Mm.
If the lead from El Mariachi is the second guitarist in Desperado in Antonio Banderas' band, and he's the guy that has the MIDI guns in his guitar cases. Mm. So the MIDI guns, they're a cool thing, but I really love his sort of like woolen suit that he wears. He's got these really dead cool trousers. I just really like the cut of his trousers. I just thought, you know, I'd like a woolen suit like that. I probably wouldn't wear it in Mexico because, you know, what are you doing wearing wool, mate? Fucking hell. But, yeah. Anyway, my point about Congo was that it's a terrible film. It's boring. The lead is kind of like not very charismatic, and it takes itself simultaneously far too seriously and not seriously enough in a way. And all you do is you go, we'll just put Bruce Campbell as the lead, just swap them. Get the guy without any charisma to get killed off in the first 3 minutes. Put Bruce Campbell in it, and then the whole film makes sense, right? Because then you're not like pissed off that you're watching kind of like this guy talk to a talking gorilla that's basically obviously a man in a suit, you know, for 90 minutes. You know, with sign language. Oh, God, it's awful. It's so bad. But then you could put Bruce Campbell in a scene where he's talking with sign language to a talking gorilla, and then all of a sudden you go, this makes sense. It's almost like it was meant to be. Like, you couldn't imagine the film being better.
Yeah. I think that's it. I think he, in fact, you're right, actually. It's funny because he isn't, because you're talking about him being almost like a parody or a pastiche of a leading man, he would actually work really well in films that might be struggling to get a bit of credibility because it makes it look like it's on purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, because we were talking about kind of like, can you imagine a film that existed where, you know, Bruce Campbell could be the lead? And yeah, I think that he could have been the lead in Dark Man. You were basically saying, other than Dark Man 2, what, you know, and it was kind of like, it is a bit of a struggle because I don't think he is kind of like a Brad Pitt or even like an Antonio Banderas or like a, he's not like a leading man in that sense for A pictures, but you could improve almost any B movie or any horror movie. But I was saying that Bruce Campbell would have been perfect as sort of like the Gabriel Byrne character in Hereditary, you know. And you go, yeah, so maybe not being in kind of like Ocean's 11 and doing George Clooney roles, but definitely kind of like coming in and like the Roddy McDowall character from Fright Night. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bruce Campbell would be great as that. And they did the remake of Fright Night and they got... David Tennant,
yeah.
Yeah, and they kind of changed it from, he's not like a horror show host, he's a Las Vegas magician. And it kind of like, you know, yeah, it's, that's the problem. I mean, what, Colin Farrell? He did the same thing with Total Recall, where they kind of like, do a remake of an absolute banger, put Colin Farrell in it, and then just... you know, take everything that's good about the originals and sort of like just dilute it all.
And, when the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man was coming out, I'd convinced myself that Bruce Campbell would be J. Jonah Jameson. And you know, I think he's great, isn't he? What's he called? The bloke who is him.
What is his name?
From Oz.
What, is he in Oz?
He's in Oz as well, yeah. What's he called? God, I forgot his name.
Some Whiplash.
J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons, yeah.
That was Natalie who found that. It wasn't me. He is great, but like in my head, I could just imagine Bruce Campbell aged up with like a buzz cut and a moustache and being really good in it.
Well, I mean, we got him in three films, so that was good. But again, you go, when's he going to get a fucking break? Like, yeah, Sam Raimi's making huge blockbuster movies. And then it's kind of like Bruce Campbell comes in and he's got a cameo in it. You go, yeah, but... And he's got a cameo in the second one. You go, yeah, but, you know. He's got a cameo in the third one.
You can imagine him showing up in something like a Guardians of the Galaxy film or something like that now, couldn't you?
Why don't they just do it?
Yeah.
I don't understand. Well, because that's the, like one of the weirdest things, isn't it? Because Evil Dead... Evil Dead 2, they're responsible for a whole generation of filmmakers, you know. And no one sort of, like, put him in their film and sort of, like, showcased him. You know, it's just kind of like, you whack him in a Quentin Tarantino film as part of an ensemble cast, write him a decent part, or you put him in, you know, something like Desperado or From Dusk Till Dawn with an ensemble cast, and then it's like, oh, we're making From Dusk Till Dawn 2. And Bruce Campbell's in it, and you go, oh my God, Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, directed by Scott Spiegel, I think it was. Mm. And it's a straight-to-video sequel, a deliberately straight-to-video. It's not like so bad that they've done it on a video budget, so it's scaled down, but we're doing a sequel to From Dusk Till Dawn, and it stars Bruce Campbell, and then you fucking count down the fucking days, the weeks, the months, to the day that... From Dusk Till Dawn 2, Texas Blood Money is released, where on the credits it will say Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, Bruce Campbell, unbelievable, cannot wait. And he appears in the first 2 minutes in a film within a film, and he gets killed in the fake film that the characters are watching in the film on TV in a motel. And you go, for fuck's sake, this was like, you can't even get a lead in a straight-to-video sequel that is being produced by two of your biggest fans. It's like, This is as close as it's like to be a football fan of a shit team. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm rooting for him. Do you know what I mean? Just come on, you can do it.
You're right, though. It's actually, it's weirder now that he hasn't had a third act, has he? He hasn't had the, like, most people get, you know, Quentin Tarantino's whole thing when he started making films was that he resurrects these sort of heroes from his childhood and his teens and things. And it's almost weird now that Bruce Campbell hasn't had that.
Well, he had Ash versus Evil Dead, right? Mm. They had three series of a sequel to the Evil Dead trilogy, right? And yeah, that's great. But it got cancelled because it was on Stars. No one subscribed to Stars. And people just downloaded it illegally, so not enough people watched it. And then it got cancelled, and it's just kind of like, you go, this is like, I mean, I went to the premiere. I mean, it was so exciting, and it was so brilliant that he was sort of like, you know, that was his kind of like third act. But even that was sort of like, oh, it got fucked. And he said, it's because you all illegally downloaded it. So I didn't. I bought it on DVD and Blu-ray, along with every single... I've got fucking 11 copies of Army of Darkness, you can't. Fucking... Because I illegally downloaded it. I fucking paid for your... Yeah. I paid for your fucking shoes for fucking 10 years, mate. How many fucking new releases of fucking Evil Dead are you going to do? Oh, it's out on Anchor Bay. Fucking Wanker Bay, more like. Fucking... I've got so many copies of those fucking films. I bought all of the books. I fucking, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, it's one film. It's an 81-minute film or something like that. And you've released it between 1980 and 2000 for 40 years. There's like three different releases of it per year because you get all the fucking revenue from it. You know, it's kind of like you release it over and over and over and over again, and like a fucking mug, I buy every fucking alternative cover because I fucking love you. I mean, it's hurtful, Nat.
I can tell. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I wear the scarf and I turn up every Saturday and I cheer him on. come on, Bruce. it's difficult. It's difficult being a Bruce Campbell fan because it's like when he is the lead, it's in something like Mind Warp, and you've got to sit through that. And it's kind of like you're better off just reading the description of it on the back because the film that you end up watching bears absolutely no resemblance to the film that they've described.
He's often not in like B movies that kind of fun B movies either. They often are just like, this is just a rubbish film. It's not like, it's not.
Alien Apocalypse. I mean, fuck me. It's not even like tongue-in-cheek fun. Do you know? But I've watched it. I've watched it. Oh.
Well done, mate. Well done.
It's all right. Okay, fine. I don't want to talk about... I don't want to put this out in the world. But this is the dark... underside of fandom, do you see? I mean, we've never really...
People need to know.
We've never really kind of, like, explored it on Fan Club, right? But part of being a fan is, you know, learning to lose things, I suppose. Learning to cope with loss and disappointment and rejection, but still coming back week in, week out. Why? I'm a bloody fan, and it means something to me. You know, if ever I got a TV show or a film, I would hire Bruce Campbell. I'd get him killed in the first 2 minutes of episode 4, long after people had stopped watching. Did you ever see the second series of Fargo, by the way?
No, is he in that?
He's Ronald Reagan.
Is he?
But I don't think it's a big part. I think I've talked to people who have seen it. And I said, "Is Ronald Reagan in it much?" And I don't think they even sort of like registered that Ronald Reagan was even in it. Okay. So, but I didn't really love the first series of Fargo. So,
No, I kind of got lost. I've heard good things about it. I think I watched the first couple and I never went back to it, really.
I sort of liked it, but then I thought it was ridiculously mean-spirited in some places. And also the tone of it wasn't quite... It was like... Because the Coen brothers have a very specific tone and the tone of it was kind of like a bit off. There's a bit when there's this guy that's selling zombie apocalypse survival kits at the back of a van. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's wacky. But it's not really Coen brothers wacky. It's kind of like, it was like one step beyond I could... Do you know what I mean? It was too... And it was slightly too broad in places. I don't know. I liked it, though. I did like it, but I still sort of like... One character gets, like, this absolutely horrible death. And, and it sort of, like, left a really bad taste in my mouth for, like, the rest of the series. But,
You know what? I was never a massive fan of Fargo, the movie.
Really?
I was a bit disappointed. I have seen it since, and I think I liked it more. But I think when I saw it, I always really liked that their films always felt like pastiches of genre films. And that just didn't feel like it was one. It felt like, but in a way, it's probably like their first proper Coen Brothers-y Coen Brothers film. But I really like Hudsucker Proxy and Crossing. And
So Hudsucker Proxy was... the reason we mentioned Crime Wave was because Bruce Campbell was meant to be the lead. It was written by Sam Raimi, Joel Coen and Ethan Coen, and it's set in a place called Hudsucker Prison. So whenever Crime Wave was made, 1987 maybe? Or maybe, no, it was before Evil Dead 2, wasn't it? Because they had to make... Maybe it was 1984. And then they had to make Evil Dead 2 to sort of like go, no, we can still... We need it. We got a hit. They had to basically have a hit so that they could progress their careers. So they did Evil Dead. They could do anything they wanted. They did Crime Wave. Crime Wave was a flop. There are some really good jokes in it, but it's not a very successful film overall. Like, it's good. Is it good? I don't think it is good. I think there's good bits in it, though. And then I like some amazing bits. The bit when she's running through the doors and shutting the doors and he's chasing her through the doors and they're in, like, a door factory. So there's just, like, hundreds of doors. That's great. And the dance contest is great. That's one of my favourite all-time jokes in any film, when they enter the dance contest. I think it's fantastic. So that was a flop, so they had to make Evil Dead 2 to be kind of like, no, and then they could sort of like make something else. So he wrote Crime Wave with the Coen brothers, and then when they made Hudsucker Proxy, which is sort of like using the name Hudsucker from Crime Wave and putting it in another film, which was a Joel Silver film, Sam Raimi wrote Hudsucker Proxy with the Coen brothers. Coen brothers directed it. Bruce Campbell is in it. And Sam Raimi's got a cameo in it. I think Sam Raimi's the one that's like trying to invent names for the hula hoop. And he's the one that goes, the daddy-o. And you just see him in silhouette. So they're sort of like all connected. Unrelated to the fact that Bruce Campbell's in it or Sam Raimi had a hand in it, I think Hudsucker Proxy is my favourite Coen Brothers film. I think it doesn't get any love, and I think it's absolutely magical.
I think it was a flop as well, which I think people almost meant in that there was a time, wasn't there, when a film flopped, it'd almost be like written off as a bad film. People just went, that's terrible, that one. No, it wasn't. It's just you never saw it.
It was their biggest budget film. It looks expensive. The special effects are great. It's like it's obviously this green screen stuff when he's like falling out of the tower. But I think there's green screen. The bit when the dude is on the magic carpet in Big Lebowski has aged worse than Tim Robbins falling out of the building in Hudsucker Proxy, and it was made 4 years later. You know,
I'll say this. I've said it before on here, but I would say if you go back to 1998 when Big Lebowski came out, you won't see a good review from it from anyone. It was like, people were just like, this is awful.
Really?
Yeah, it was like people hated it. Empire magazine hated it.
Did they?
And it was like all this. And at the time, it was because of Fargo, really, because Fargo had been seen as such like a proper movie for them. I think the idea that they'd then done this much broader comedy was almost seen as this kind of, oh, just when you got good, you make this.
Oh,
was
really?
The sort of attitude to it.
I can sort of understand that because it's ridiculous, but it's sort of like a return to kind of like Raising Arizona. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's it, and I think that was my take on it when, like, I was a bit like, oh, great. And I was a bit, yeah, at the time, I was a bit disappointed by Fargo. And it's probably one of their films I've watched least.
That's so strange.
I've seen it, I've probably seen it for the last time about 15 years ago. And I reckon I'd probably like it if I watched it now.
I think it's great.
At the time, I was never really into it.
It's got an amazing Steve Buscemi performance. Frances McDormand is great. William H. Macy is great. The soundtrack is incredible. It looks beautiful. It's got a cameo from Bruce Campbell in it, where they took an old soap opera he was in. When William H. Macy's wife is tied up to a chair and she's got a sack over her head, they leave her in a room watching an old Bruce Campbell soap opera. So it's not like he's not actually in the film. But yeah. They have footage of him from a TV show in the film.
Bruce Campbell's also in the Coen Brothers' Lady Killers, isn't he, for a bit?
So this is my theory. He's in Lady Killers and he's in Intolerable Cruelty and he's in Hudsucker Proxy. And if he actually turns up for work, then it's either a flop or it's their worst film. But if they use old footage of him from another thing, it'll get an Oscar. So I think it's sort of like cursed, isn't it? But
Joel and Ethan Coen are listening, they need to get some old footage.
They need to get some old footage of Xena Warrior Princess and whack that in their next film and they'll get an Oscar. We've got to play a song now then we'll chat some more because that's the basic, it's a podcast, isn't it? What are you fucking expecting?
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back! Oh, God! That's what I watched, Evil Dead 2.
Okay. I'll tell you what I saw this week. On a related matter, I saw the film High Fidelity.
The John Cusack film?
John Cusack film. I was intrigued. I'd read the book in the last few weeks and I was sort of intrigued by it. And I watched the film again, having read the book. And it's a really faithful adaptation. It's a really good adaptation of the book. But I don't know how much I liked the film or the book at the end of it. When it first came out, I saw the movie and I really liked it. And it's not aged terribly well. I think part of the reason it hasn't aged that well is Jack Black, who I think is like, I don't know if I can take this performance now. It feels like Jack Black belongs to a different era to me. But there is a bit in it John Cusack is discussing the film Reservoir Dogs, and he uses it as a thing to say that when his ex says that she hasn't slept with a new boyfriend yet, he says to Jack Black, when you say you haven't done something yet, does that mean you're going to do it, or does it mean you're not going to do it? He says, for example...
Is that in the book?
In the book and the film, but in the book he says, it's Reservoir Dogs in the book.
Yeah, and in the film, it's...
Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
But the joke doesn't kind of make as much sense, because he talks about it... He also says Evil Dead 2, and he goes through it, goes, yeah, because it's really violent, it's really funny, and it's also got an amazing soundtrack.
And it doesn't.
It doesn't. So it's obvious that you go, well, he is talking about Reservoir Dogs in the book, and that makes more sense.
Because it's got an amazing soundtrack. But you don't go away from Evil Dead 2 and go, what a tune. It's all sort of like Atmos stuff.
That's what I mean. And it feels
Joseph LaDuca, though, who went on to do Hercules and Xena and Army of Darkness. I can never work out which bit Danny Elfman did in Army of Darkness and which bit... Joseph LaDuca did, because basically it all sounds like Danny Elfman. So maybe Danny Elfman did the March of the Dead song, which is what he did, but I don't know. It's my fault. I haven't ever really looked it up, even though I've got a fucking copy of the fucking soundtrack on vinyl.
It's a weird thing to change, isn't it, for the film? Is it like you're not allowed to mention Reservoir Dogs without giving... them some money or something?
I think that it was maybe John Cusack wanted to reference Evil Dead 2.
Then you'd just change, you'd make the third bit something else, wouldn't you?
And they might have changed it on the day.
Yeah.
I don't know. It is a weird thing to change. I don't remember it in the book. I remember, because I really like that book, but I haven't read it since. But I know what you mean. I think John Cusack is quite an unlikable character in the film. Do you know what I mean? He's like... Yeah.
I think that's meant to be the... I don't think you're fully meant to be entirely on board with him. I think...
It's about how complicated relationships are. So it's kind of like, you know, he's your lead character, but he's not really a hero.
No.
He's sort of, like, got quite a lot of unlikable qualities as well. It's meant to be, like... It's complicated, isn't it?
Mm. And it's like, that wasn't really my problem with the film or the book. It was more that, I don't know, I just was a bit kind of, I don't know, and I thought both were fine. That's what I thought. But I remember really liking the film. And now I think it's like, it's fine. It's totally fine. I was expecting to, you know, and I'm sort of not surprised. It's not something I would have imagined would definitely age well. But it really hasn't. And it feels very tracked in its era as well. And Jack Black as well, that I was sort of kind of... You watching it, it's a bit like... I found it a bit kind of squirmy, a lot of his performance, a bit kind of cringy.
Jack Black? it's weird, because he was sort of slightly unrefined. But that was his breakout role, wasn't it? But...
Yeah.
He was in stuff. He was in like The Cable Guy before then. He was in Neverending Story 3. And him and Tim Robbins are sort of like part of that.
Yes.
Like an acting troupe, aren't they? And I think John Cusack sort of, they're all in, well, John Cusack is in Bob Roberts, isn't he?
Is that, do you remember that film that's about Orson Welles?
Yes. Yeah.
What's that film?
It's sort of like The Cat's Meow or something like that.
That's the Bogdanovich one about Chaplin. But it's a similar type of ensemble thing. Is it called something like When the Bow Breaks or something like that? Is it?
Yeah. Okay.
I know. Yeah, that thing.
Yeah. But that's got... Isn't that like John Cusack, Tim Robbins and Cradle Will Rock?
Cradle Will Rock.
Yeah. And Jack Black. Is Jack Black Orson Welles in it?
Isn't he... Oh, God, no. I don't think he's Orson Welles. I think he's like a ventriloquist dummy in a show, right? He plays like the dummy that someone does on stage, like
right.
a sort of fake ventriloquist act with two people playing, one playing the ventriloquist and him playing the puppet.
Right.
I think it's like double act with someone in it.
Okay.
I remember really liking that film, actually. I'd be interested in it again.
I've not seen it. What I will say, I mean, I like High Fidelity. And I really like the book, and I like Nick Hornby. So when we were making Eat Your Heart Out, what happened was we were doing. Me and my girlfriend had just split up, and I was going through a phase of just taking as much work as I could get to sort of like keep sort of like active and working, and they offered me. This Channel 4 pilot for a food show, and it was originally called Dirty Filthy Food, and it was about me, but it was a non-TX, which means they're not going to televise it. They'll make a pilot, but no one will see it. Just the channels will see it, and they'll decide whether they want to make a series or not, right? But it doesn't air on TV, right? And I was just thinking, this is perfect, because I can do this, I can have a go at presenting, it's not going to be humiliating, I give it a go, and it's work, and it gets me out of the house, and I don't have to deal with my breakup. And so we did like the episode in Manchester, and the whole thing was kind of, it was like Top Gear for food, right? And it was a bit of a weird project. It was me like talking directly down the camera and say, hello, we're in Manchester, home of Oasis, Smiths and the Hacienda. And today I'm going to be eating breakfast, lunch, dinner, and maybe a snack. So join me on Dirty Filthy Food. And it was basically me meant to be going to sort of like absolute shitholes, eating the most disgusting sort of like greasy food that we could find, and then giving it a rating out of 10, right? And the first thing we did was we went to this jerk chicken restaurant where I met this lovely Jamaican couple, and they were sort of like old, and we were like eating jerk chicken in... their restaurant, and I'd make the jerk chicken, and I met like I was in the kitchen, and I was like helping out and making everything, and then at the end I ate the food, and there was a moment where the food was so delicious, and I kind of like, but I, you know, there was nearly a tear in my eye, and I was just kind of like, no one's cooked something this nice for me in ages, you know. And I think I sort of like said, not even my mum makes food this nice, you know. And then I come out of the restaurant and they say, now give it a rating out of 10. And I was like, well, it's 10, isn't it? And then I said, and to the producer, I was like, it's always going to be 10 because I've just met them and I've just made, it's a pointless... It's a pointless element to the show, me coming out of a restaurant, meeting the people that own the restaurant, working with them, spending a morning with them or an afternoon with them, eating their food, and then turning around. I'm never going to give it like a 3 or like a 1, right? It's always going to be 10, right? Because I'm not a cunt, right? So so I found that like frustrating. And then and it was just sort of like this, it wasn't really me, do you know what I mean? It was this really weird show, right? where it's just kind of like, what you need is you need a proper lad. You need like a bloke to be doing this. And it's dirty. I don't even like junk food. Do you know what I mean? And it's kind of like, and also I've got like eating issues and eating disorders and stuff like that. I don't want to have like a show that is me just stuffing my face with junk food and then open myself up to the possibility that people are going to write in and call me like a fat cunt and all of that stuff like on Twitter. And I was just like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to put myself through that. But I am interested in food and I love cooking. So to do a food show is great, but maybe it's not this food show, you know. And then we filmed like this segment in the evening with this woman. We were making ice cream. She's like an ice cream maker, right? And so we were making ice cream. And to make ice cream, you have to separate egg whites and egg yolks. And I hate eggs, right? And so there was this scene where I was literally separating egg whites and egg yolks with my hands. And I was gagging, right? And my hands are covered in egg white. And I'm just like, but I'm being sick. It just looks like fucking snot. It's just like, it's just, I'm being sick. And then what happens is my face really starts itching. And I start like uncontrollably sneezing. And then I'm just like, but I can't do anything about it because my hands are covered in this egg, right? And I turn around and I say, have you got cats? And she said, yeah, I've got like three. And it's like, I'm allergic to cats. And then there's just this thing where I'm meant to be like making ice cream. And it's this whole segment where it just got worse and worse and worse, where I'm gagging at the fact that I hate the fucking ingredients and I'm sneezing, I'm tearing my fucking face off because I'm allergic to cats. And then we eventually make this ice cream and I eat it. And I go, if we could make a series like that, where it's just sort of like stuff that's sort of like getting more and more out of control, I'd be more interested in that. And then I watched the pilot and I didn't love it. So I was just like, okay, I'm not gonna, I don't really wanna do like a series. And it went around and Channel 4 turned it down and I sort of forgot all about it, that it existed. And then like a year later, the producer got back in contact and he said, well, good news, we've got a series on Dave. And I was just like, oh, really? And they goes, yeah, they've just commissioned 20 episodes. And I was like, of that? 20 episodes of that? And they said, yeah. And I said, I don't want to make it. I said, I don't want to do it. I don't want to make 20 episodes of that. And so they took me out for like a lot of dinners. And eventually they sort of like persuaded me to do the series. And eventually I think he was just desperate at the end. And he just said, look, you can do anything you want. You can do absolutely anything you want. And I was just like, well, I wasn't even playing hard to get. I was just like, I'm not interested. I don't want to be a presenter. I want to be a comedian. I don't want to be a celebrity. I don't want to do this to be famous. I don't want to do it just for the sake of being on TV, you know. And I don't want to do like a food show where I'm like eating junk food and giving it ratings out of 10, right? So he said, you can make anything you want. So I went home and I watched High Fidelity. And I was just like, well, if we can make a food show that's like High Fidelity, where I'm going through and sort of like reliving memories, like I go through a breakup and then I go back to my parents' house and my mum cooks me dinner and I go to like our favourite restaurants that we used to go to. And then I travelled like to France to get away from... you know, do you know what I mean? If we could sort of like put like a storyline around it, make it into sort of like a comedy show as well as a food show, and kind of like and made it autobiographical, then I'd be up for that. So we did it, and then it got delivered to Dave eventually, and they had no idea that we'd changed it, and I got absolutely bollocked. They were just like, what the fuck? It's like, what the fuck is this? This isn't the fucking show that we asked for. We asked for dirty, filthy food. What the fuck is Eat Your Heart Out? And it was just like, what do you mean? And the producer never told them that we changed it. And it's just like, and everyone was just like, well, they delivered it. And they said, well, yeah, but it's better than what you ordered, isn't it? And they were like, yeah. So like people are saying, are you going to make another series? It's just like, I don't think Dave are talking to me. I think they were fucking furious. Not my fault. But it was just like I never heard from them. Like then they changed the time slot it was on. It was on at 7:30, I think, or 7 o'clock, and they changed the time slot to 11 o'clock at night without telling me. And it was just like it was absolute fucking car crash. It gets repeated all the time though. People love it, but like And it's a really good show. The reason it's good is because of all of the elements that we changed. But it was because of High Fidelity that we did it. That we did it. Me and David Trent. Do you know what? I had to write... It was fucking mental. They gave me... Guess how long they gave me to write 20 episodes? 16 episodes.
I don't know. It's obviously not going to be...
2 weeks. Months. 2 weeks. They gave me 2 weeks to write 16 episodes. And it was over Easter holiday. So it was actually two four-day weeks. To write 16 episodes. Right? And... fucking hell. And sometimes they would change the guest and the location the night before, and I'd have to write a fucking episode overnight. It was an absute, you know, go, are you going to make any more? It was a fucking nightmare. Plus, you're eating food morning, noon and night, right? And there's never a point where you don't need a shit. It's just like, it's just literally, you're just stuffed the whole time. It's fucking, and you've got cameras on you. It's absolutely fucking, you know, that's a nice job.
Recording that, you had to get a personal trainer, didn't you? Just to get rid of the weight.
I got a personal trainer after I did Eat Your Heart Out because I put on like a stone and a half or something. It's fucking crazy. Anyway, that's the story behind Eat Your Heart Out. So if you do want another series, write to Dave. Don't write to me. It's got absolutely fucking nothing to do with me. I would do. The terrible, terrible conditions that we had to, like, make it under. And it was one person's fault. Right, so Heineck and that. We're going to do fan mail now. I've never said that. Oh, God, got it off my chest. Hey, Nick and Nat. What's up, you lovely boys? Nick had a great business idea for you. What if Apple did a new Siri version with your voice so that Apple users can ask Nick Siri to be addressed as Gunts? Thank me later. Cheers, Sam. Kiss, kiss. Great.
Some money of Apple.
Again, get in contact with Apple. I don't see it as my job to pitch to Apple... a cunt app for Siri.
Dear Nick and Nat, I've recently watched the latest mob documentary on Netflix. It's amazing. Have you watched it? I really recommend it. Thanks, Holly.
No, I've not seen it.
I don't know what it is.
Hello, you pair of cunts. As a fellow cunt, this is a compliment. Cunts are the best. Sorry. Hello, you pair of cunts. As a fellow cunt, this is a compliment.
Cunts are the best.
Do you like summer, Damien?
I love summer. It is, I would say, in one of my top four seasons.
Hi, is Indiana Jones worth watching? I can't be asked, but my girlfriend says that it is her favourite man and I should be more like him. Cheers, Woody.
Woody? I mean, why do you listen to this? You've never seen an Indiana Jones film. Why are you listening to this show?
What's in this for you? Indiana Jones. It depends. I think it's 50-50 on Indiana Jones. Two absolute bangers, and then you've got Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusade. Okay.
I'd love to get into films and I've only seen Ghostbusters 2 as I'm more into music.
Brian Johnson's doing a good job this week, isn't he, reading that?
What are some good entry point films I can watch? Nose Job in Sussex.
Good entry point films? John Carpenter's The Thing, maybe?
I've heard that Evil Dead 2 has a good soundtrack, so that's worth checking out if you like music.
Howdy, guys. I would love to pick your brains about America. Have you been there and do you like it? My friends want to go, but I'm not sure about the flight time, and I'm not really into American films or TV shows. From Tricky Steve.
I'm probably not the best person to ask about America, but I've got a friend that sort of like pops into America every now and then, sometimes just for an afternoon. So we can put you in contact with him.
Hello, guys. As I'm still in the lockdown and I've watched all of Netflix, I think I might be trying to get into yoga. Could you teach me how to do it, please, Sally?
Get into yoga? Not my...
All of these letters have the same tone. Are they, like, written by the same person?
You think it's because it's Brian Johnson? Or do you think it's because...
No, it's like they're all sort of... There's no proper... Who listens to this and writes in? Who are our listeners?
Who writes this?
Yeah.
Just a bunch of, it's just like, they're like, I mean, it's
I think people probably think we make these letters up.
I think it's a little bit soul-destroying, isn't it, to read these? And you go, hey, guys, if you want to get into Giallo movies, then why not write in and we can discuss what your favourite Giallo movie is? And then the next week, you read in the fan mail, and it's literally people taking the fucking piss. And it's like, I don't know why we fucking bother. I mean, they're like talking about fucking opening up fucking FUBAR again, and we have to go into the fucking studio to do this. So like, I can just about tolerate having the piss taken out of me in my fucking living room, but I'm not going to get a fucking Uber to enjoy that fucking experience. For fuck's sake. I'm not going to spend money, more money on this show than I fucking make out of it, just to be fucking humiliated on, you know, I was going to say live radio, but it's obviously pre-recorded, and then it's a podcast, so... I guess it's limited on... Anyway, if you've got nothing positive or intelligent to say, stop fucking writing in. Right? I can do without you, you fucking cunts. This is fucking... It's going to be fan mail, not like people that, you know, are going to fucking needle at us mail. Yeah, that's good. We'll use that as the clip.
Yes, please.
Greetings! I heard some fan mail asking you to come to Seaside and do a roadshow. I agree this would be for the best. I am from South Sea and would love to have you here. When can you come? I have a garage you can sleep in. Oh, for fuck's sake! I was almost moved!
So was I. Someone was wanting to come to South Sea and pay him a visit.
I thought someone actually wanted us to come to South Sea to do a roadshow where we could talk about John Carpenter's The Thing, amongst other films. And then at the end, it's like they've offered to make us sleep in their fucking garage. No, thank you. No, thank you, Doc Red.
Oh. Right, it's all fan mail, then. That's it.
That's the fan mail. All right.
Do a song and get a guest on.
I kiss at last the beloved crown of my land that I left one day with my heart full of pain. I have looked in the faces of my old friends, but now do you look at me as my old friend? And now what happens, you must tell me. Remember who I am. If you see a man with downcast eyes and ragged clothes walking through your village, don't shout him, but go at his side. I'm that man, and now I beg you, help me. I need you. I need you. My sweetheart, I was dead. To take my place, you shall pay for the space lie. Those who saw me as a runtime man, those who tried to destroy our world, shall leave forever our.
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back! What was that song that we just played, Nathaniel?
It was the Return of Ringo soundtrack, Ennio Morricone.
Oh, that's great. It's brilliant. Right, we're joined live in the studio. We're not live, pre-recorded. 5 days in advance this time. Not enough gap between the last episode and this episode. Anyway, here we are. We're making the best of a wonderful situation. Joined in the studio now by comedian Ken Cheng. How you doing?
Hey, yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
How is... Were you... Okay, so what's the date today? What's the date?
It's the 27th or 27th. The 2nd of August, possibly?
So Edinburgh would be starting...
Oh, God, it would be.
It is crazy. It is crazy. I was thinking that. How is it August?
Would you have gone up this year?
No, I was taking a year off, actually. This was my first year off in, like, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. I was going to take a year off, and I feel absolutely cheated by this.
Yeah, me too, me too.
Not technically a year off, but it is a year of our lives. But also, yeah. It's also, I think, kind of like taking a year off every so often to have, like, maybe, like, a fallow period so that you can kind of, like... come up with ideas rather than feeling like you're just churning stuff out is good. Yeah. But it's like one of the most uneventful years. And nothing's happened to me other than I haven't left my flat.
It's hard to turn that into a show.
Well, imagine the state of everyone's shows if all they'd been about was what they'd done in lockdown.
Yeah. I think they will be. They will be next year.
Of course.
Next year's people are going to come back. It's all going to be the same show.
Yeah.
There's going to be 500 shows called My Corona, and it's literally just going to be people talking about Corona. And I just think, you know, maybe next year would be a good one to take off as well, because... Mm.
I think so as well. I'm not sure it will come back in its full... It will even be, like, normal next year, because we still don't know what a live comedy will look like in a year's time. It's actually coming up very quickly.
So what do we do then?
This. We just... It's all Zoom nowadays.
I hate it. I can just about get away with the radio show, but like I've never met you before, have I, Ken?
No, I don't think we. I don't think we have, Matt.
I saw you on. But does this count as meeting now?
I think so. Yeah, I think it just about does.
Okay, so if I see you in the real world, I can say, "Hey, remember me? We've met already."
I think we did interact. In a gig that I was in the audience maybe like 9 years ago. I think we did interact.
Oh,
but
so
you were watching Nick.
But not in a proper way. You were on stage and you probably asked me one question and I said an answer and then you moved on instantly.
Right. Okay, well, I'm pretty good at remembering every single member of the audience that has ever come to see me. So, yeah, I thought you looked familiar. Hey. Well, it's great to know that now you're a successful comedian, that I had some part in inspiring you to be
success. 100% part. That interaction made me seek it out.
Absolutely. What a great guy I am. So I saw you in Bilal's acting thing. So Bilal was a guest at the beginning of lockdown, just while he was doing it, and it was before he started doing his... Pez United.
Oh yeah.
Twitch feeds, which are incredible.
They're great.
I really loved his acting school thing, but I thought the episode that you were in was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I wrote to you to tell you, but like,
yes, that's very kind.
I lost my mind when I saw it. I just thought it was so funny. I don't know. Do you want to talk a bit about doing that?
Yeah, it was really fun. I've not really done that much stuff like that, but when I do, it is really fun. Like, it's just, there's no script at all. We went in, no idea what was going to happen. There was no brief. It was just purely, just go with whatever. And it just, the whole 20, I think we filmed for 25 minutes, maybe more, maybe half an hour. We had quite a lot of footage. It got edited down, but it was like 30 minutes of just straight messing around. And
I watched it last night on Nick's recommendation, and I was in bits. I watched about four of them back to back. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, thanks. That's very kind. I think it's a great thing Bilal is doing. Like, he's got a lot of great guests on it, and yeah, I think people should check it out. At least I think there should be more stuff like that. People just kind of messing around. I feel that's where the real comedy comes.
Did you do the last episode? Were you in the last one?
I think it was the last one, yeah. I think it was.
I just thought, yeah. I mean, I thought they were all good, but it built, built up to you, and I just thought it was, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So when did you start doing comedy?
I started as a comedy like quite a long time ago. 2010 was my first gig, but I was just doing it in Cambridge in the student scene. I wasn't even a student. I just lived in Cambridge and it was a nice scene there.
So there is like a proper comedy scene outside of lights as well, or is that what you're part of?
It was kind of that, but it's kind of a bit bigger than that. The stuff like, I know Nick's done the Wolves and Howler, the gigs like that, which are just really, really nice gigs where I think it's still in the student scene. It's not technically Footlights, but it's sort of like a network of that.
And what's that like? Because does it feel like, I mean, I guess you've got nothing to compare it to other university towns, but it feels like there's that gig and there's other gigs to do within, there actually is a sort of little mini circuit in Oxford or?
Cambridge, yeah.
Cambridge.
It's okay, I don't care. There was, I don't give a shit about that. There was quite a big stand-up scene when I did it, when I was living there, because you had people who are now quite big. They were still 21, 20. People like Phil Wang and Ahir Shah and like Liam Williams and those bunch were all in their student days. They were all like early 20s and they were like very professional for being like 20 years old. They seemed like they were already like professional comics, and that created quite a huge scene around it. People loved going to see comedy gigs. You could do your first gig to like 200 people. That's like such a great way to start, because if you do it in London, you're going to do it to like five people who are all acts. So
it was certainly around when me and Nick were around in sort of 2007, when he was, must have been incredibly young, right?
He was 15.
15 or 16.
He started when he was 15, yeah. And then he went to Cambridge.
So I think, I don't know if he got to the point where he had to sneak into pubs to do gigs, but I know that gig, what's it, Star of Kings by...
Oh, yeah,
that's right.
It used to be Lion's Den Comedy, and he used to do that. And so I just remember that he was 15 or 16, and me and him and my dad played Scrabble together. And I put down QI... as a word,
yeah,
which is like it's a, if you've got classic. A Q and there's an I on there, you put QI down, you get rid of your Q. And they both contested that it wasn't a word, and I said it's a word, it's a Scrabble word.
It is
word.
A word. It's a classic Scrabble word.
Ahir's so clever that my dad just automatically deferred to him and went like, yeah, and he believed him over his own son. And I wasn't allowed to put a fucking 15-year-old, and I wasn't allowed to put QI down. I had to go back and I fucking, they took the piss out of me at the table. I had to go back and fucking Facebook him and look it up and say, look, I told you it was a... We didn't have phones back then. Can you believe that? We couldn't have even fact-checked it. But, so I had to go home on my laptop and message her here and say, see, QI is a fucking word. 15-year-old gentleman. But fucking, it was fine. We all got... you get over these things. It was 2007.
It's taken 13 years, but you finally
got... I've dealt with it. I've dealt with it.
You've had years of therapy, so it's fine.
His own son. He wouldn't... He just met him. But that's the power of Ahir Shah.
He seems smart, doesn't he? But...
does seem smart, yeah.
He doesn't know about how to sort of like mop up the last remaining points on a Scrabble board.
If you don't know about Chi, you're a rookie.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the obvious ones. That's one of the go-tos of a Scrabble.
So you won the Joke of the Fringe in 2017.
I did.
What is that, the Dave joke?
The Dave one, yeah. Is that the one you won it, didn't you?
I won it in 2011.
Wow. There we go.
Did you get an award? Did you get a?
Yeah, I got a trophy. The is it an elephant? A glass elephant?
Yeah, it's like a Perspex plastic elephant, right?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I've got that. It's just up there.
Oh, yeah, mine's in the living room. It's just out there.
Yeah, I've got all of my awards on a shelf.
great stuff. You should have it in shot.
I don't want to be a prick. I just talk about them. What was your joke?
It's the one about the pound coin. Should I repeat it?
Go on. I haven't heard it.
I'm not a fan of the new pound coin, but then again, I hate all change.
Great. How did you feel about that? How did you feel about that joke you've just done?
Making the room go silent for 5 seconds, and then eventually you feel out of politeness to go, great.
How did you feel about the award?
It was weird. It was so surreal. I mean, it was my first solo hour in Edinburgh, so I was not expecting it at all. And then I just got a phone call saying, oh, by the way, you've won Dave Joke of the Fringe. We're going to announce it in a week. I was like, okay, great. That is crazy.
Because it's not a, because that's the thing, it's not a competition that you enter.
Yeah, exactly. So you're just never expecting it. And obviously you're going in like actually wanting people to enjoy your show and praise your full show, but you get this. I was just very happy to receive it. It's entirely luck, complete luck, given that you don't try for it, and your joke just goes into the machine or whatever, and they spit out a joke that wins.
Well, maybe you've got the right attitude. I was furious.
Were you?
Well, they print it in The Sun.
Yeah.
They print it in like every single newspaper. So you can't use that joke again.
Yeah, no, if you use it on stage, you're just the audience go, way.
Yeah, exactly. And and then also, because you haven't entered it, you haven't gone like, this is my favourite joke.
Yeah.
You will forever, every time you have an interview or like they write an article about you, they will forever go, this is Ken Cheung. He did the pound coin joke from, I did the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, I remember.
And they reference that in almost every article that they write about me. And you go, that's not even, my dad wrote that joke. Do you know what I mean? My dad wrote me an email which had something along those lines in the email, and then I edited his email and cut it down to, it was like three paragraphs, and I cut it down to like a one-liner, and then I put it in my show. But it was me and my dad. You go, it's not even a fair representation of what I do as a comedian.
Yeah, and that's basically it. I just take it. I guess I just see it for what it is. And the money was good. It helped me break even instead of lose a couple grand.
What did you get?
$2,000.
Was it $2,000? Did I get $2,000 or did I get $1,000?
I don't know. No.
I think I bought a laptop.
I just paid off my Edinburgh. I paid off the amount I was going to lose.
How many solo shows have you done in total?
I've done
now?
Three now. So yeah, I did one last year, my third one last year.
And then, but if you, so you started doing, so when did you do your first Edinburgh? How old are you now?
I'm 31 now. I debuted, my first solo hour was 2017. So that's when I won the joke. But I've been going to Edinburgh like every year for ages, but not like doing much.
Not even doing like package shows or anything like that before that.
I did like a 15-minute mixed bill the year before, and I did spots couple of years before that. But the first couple of years, I just went up. I went up just for fun. There used to be a poker tournament at the same time in Edinburgh. It used to be the UKIPT, and it was like a £500 buy-in poker tournament. I would go up, play a few days of that, and then just watch The Fringe.
Wow. Because that's it. You left. You were a big, like, poker player, or are still a big poker player?
I am now, as of lockdown, I'm back into the poker because comedy is dead, so I need to actually make some money.
So that's online poker, right?
Yeah, it's all online. I play online.
Can you play other games online?
As in, like...
That's in card games.
Not for any real money. The poker is much bigger than anything else.
So I like playing shithead.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you can play shithead anywhere.
So is there not like an online... Yeah. Oh, well, do you know what?
There might be.
You're not Google.
I've never looked into shithead. I used to play shithead all the time when I was 16, but...
I'm sort of like addicted to it, and I've been playing, as... You have like social, is there social bubbles? I've been able to play shithead for the first time in like 3 or 4 months. And
it's good.
Yeah, it is good. But like, I think that there should be like an online card game program where you can sort of like
play anything.
Play other games other than poker, because I can't. Yeah. I've never played poker. So you studied maths.
Yeah. Right?
So does that mean that comes into your poker playing ability?
Yeah, I think a lot of poker players have quite a mathsy brain.
Do you count cards?
No, that's a blackjack. That's in blackjack, because they don't shuffle the deck, so you can remember where the cards are, or at least.
What do you mean that you don't? Oh, look, fucking hell. They've got Shithead Online. They've got Shithead Online. Brilliant. Okay, cool.
Well, that's finish the show first.
Absolutely doesn't matter. That's great. Thanks, Natalie. It's quite distracting, but you two chat amongst yourselves. I'm just going to play online Shithead.
So it is then, you see it as very much like a skill that involves maths, and it's not like some people are just magically better at poker.
No. Yeah, there's no like. Well, it's kind of maths. It's also psychology. It's kind of mixing the two, because you need maths to kind of understand all the odds and stuff. But then there's the psychology of like going, well, I have to put myself into the other person's shoes and think, what are they thinking about the game, and respond according to that. That requires all sorts of different skills.
And you can see them.
No, not online. You just. That's the thing. You can actually play poker without seeing a person. The body language is one element of reading someone, but actually the way they bet, like, let's say you have an opponent who only bets big when they have the best possible hand. You could work that out, and then you could just change your strategy up and go, oh, you know what, I'll avoid them when they bet big and exploit them that way. So that's all part of the game. So it's all betting information.
But it's kind of like you're reading... Because you're not reading their face and their body language, you're kind of... It's weird, isn't it? Because you can sort of, like, tell a lot about... I guess what you're saying is you can sort of tell a lot about a person just on paper.
Yes, because the betting provides so much information. There's loads of... It all tells a story. And I'm trying to think if there's an equivalent game where what they do in the game tells some sort of story, but that is what the game is when you, like... basically pare it down to its fundamentals. Is everything in it, the actual game, is like all stories and stuff.
Does it feel to you like a precarious way to make a living? Or does it feel like you're confident enough to be like, I'm all right with this, I'll make some money by the end of a month, I'll be okay?
As of 2 weeks ago, I feel confident. For the whole of lockdown, I was losing money. For the first 3 months of lockdown, March to June, it was tough. I was so rusty. You keep a graph of your winnings to track it, and it just kept going up and down. I was pretty much losing like a bunch, and then winning it back, and then losing a bunch. And now, for the first time in this month, it's been a straight line upwards. So that's been good.
It's funny that you can feel rusty. To me, it almost feels like it's a thing you have or don't have. But it is a thing. If you don't play enough, you lose it.
Yeah, it's a discipline. It's like any other sport, I guess. Or game or whatever. You have to be in the zone.
Well, it's like stand-up in that regard then, right?
Yeah, it's very similar to stand-up. I think it's got a lot of the same kind of emotional swings.
It's sort of addictive.
Sort of, yeah. Like, one, addictive. It's addictive when you're losing, because the brain shortcuts it, so it doesn't like... Your brain goes into overdrive when you're losing money. So if you're down any amount of money, your brain just goes, make this stop. Do anything possible to get back into the black. And so you keep playing. Sometimes you'll just keep playing when you're losing.
I know when I'm playing Shithead.
Yeah.
I'll always be like, all right, we'll play best of three. All right, we'll play best of five.
Seven. That's the same thing.
And then it's also sort of like, it's like, if I've lost that round, if I've lost that game, then I'll keep playing until I win. Yeah. I can walk away when I've won.
Yeah, that's the same.
You... But if I've lost, then... And, like, so I play Shithead a lot, right?
Yeah.
And I love it, right? And I find that addictive. But you don't play it for money, right?
Yeah.
So, but you could make money off of... So I'm good at Shithead, right? Yeah. I'm really good at Shithead. I'm really good. I have, like, ways of kind of, like... getting other people's good cards out of them by, like, if I put, like, a three down when it's high, I can sort of, like, extract all of their good cards, and then I can burn them with, like, it's kind of, yeah, like, I've got my little tricks.
You've got some strategy. You've got strategy ideas, yeah.
So if I've got a strategy for a non-financially beneficial game like Shithead, I could transfer those skills over to poker.
Yeah, for sure. Like, the game, all games like link into each other. All card games, even video games. A lot of poker players came from video games, competitive video games, and then a lot come from, like, the other card games like Magic the Gathering and Yu-Gi-Oh. I remember my friend who used to play that. He used to play Yu-Gi-Oh competitively.
So is that your? How did you start off? How did you know you were good at poker?
We started playing in school in lunch times when we were 17. We would just, like, have a game for a couple hours, and we just gamble with... We'd use Skittles instead of chips. We'd just bet with Skittles. And I've always liked games. I think I was a bit into chess as a kid. I wasn't that good, but I was a bit into it. I was kind of good for... I was good against anyone who doesn't play chess, but I couldn't beat anyone who was good at chess. And I played a lot of video games as well. I played, like, a game called Counter-Strike Online when I was 15. So I always had that kind of game brain.
But are they more like strategy games?
Yeah, the mix of strategy games, and I played first-person shooters and stuff. Yes, that kind of stuff.
And are you someone that gambles anyway? Do you like gambling or not outside of poker?
Not really. I don't know much about... I don't do sports. I occasionally gamble on elections. I gamble on elections and the Oscars. The Oscars are always a good thing to gamble on.
You're kind of like, in a way, you're a casual bettor in terms of gambling.
Yeah.
You're not, but it's just the poker that you kind of...
Yeah. I got really into poker because my friends started playing online. So I was like, you know what, I'll give it a go, put some money online, and then just... kept going.
Did you put bets on the Oscars this year?
Did I? I think I did put a bet on, but I didn't bet on Parasite.
Yeah, right. So I saw it 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Me and Nathaniel were talking about it a bit yesterday.
Yeah.
I think it's insane that it won both.
Both the...
Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it, yeah.
I think it's really good, and I really love the director. I really loved his film that he made called The Host.
Yeah, The Host is great. Have you seen Memories of Murder?
I've not seen Memories of Murder, but I looked at his IMDb page, and I realised I'd actually seen quite a few of his films.
Yeah, they're good.
And I really like him, and I just thought, like, and Parasite, definitely, I think, win one or the other.
Yeah.
You know, but both was just kind of like, it's sort of crazy, because it is a really good film. Yeah. I don't think it's his best film. And I think that the first half is definitely much better than the second half.
The first half is very, very well set up. It's very funny.
If it had won Best Picture and not Best Foreign Language Film, that would be even more insane, wouldn't it?
Yes, okay.
Yeah, that's the problem. Maybe. But also there wasn't... Well, what other film do you think should have won Best Picture? Because the one that swept up the rest of the awards was 1917, but... It seems to have nothing to it besides, oh, here's one long tracking shot.
No, see, I thought 1917 was an incredible film. Terms of what is cinema, what is... You know, it's kind of like, you couldn't do that as...
No.
I mean, I saw it in IMAX.
Oh, right,
and I found it incredibly overwhelming. And also because it was set in World War One, there's not really a lot of modern films. It's normally World War Two.
Yeah.
And I felt like I'd never really considered, like, what trench warfare was really like.
Mm.
And I thought it did a really good job of showing you a world that is kind of like not really deeply that explored these days. And also they did it in such a cinematic way that it was cinema, do you know what I mean? It's the only thing you can do. So I think actually probably 1917...
Fair enough. I haven't seen it, but I just...
Well, when you see it...
Yeah.
Either watch it on the biggest screen you can.
Yeah.
Get as close to a small screen as you can. Because I thought it was... But do you know what I mean? It was just like, have you ever seen the film Gravity with Sandra Bullock in it?
I have seen Gravity.
That is kind of like a roller coaster. That's like a theme park ride. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really gimmicky, and you kind of you watch it, and then you go, "Well, that was good. What are we going to have for dinner?" And it's like a one watch. You watch it, and then you never think about it ever again.
Yeah.
And I thought with 1917, it was sort of like Gravity in that respect, except for it stuck with me for weeks, and I felt like because it was attached to something like World War One, it was sort of educational. You know, I just found it. I thought it was a really great film, and I thought, from the point of view of filmmaking, the way that they made it was actually just really innovative and interesting. And I didn't even. I think that there's an Alfred Hitchcock film called Rope.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Which is sort of like the whole film is in one shot.
Yeah.
And it, although it's like I think it was 50s or 60s. It's very sort of like gimmicky.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of the time when they do these sort of like one shot kind of films, it does come across as gimmicky. But I thought it actually served the purpose of the story in 1970.
Yeah.
I also think Parasite, no one predicted it would work.
I think the Oscars like to do that. I think they always like to go against what's been winning a bit. The same happened with The Revenant. Everyone thought The Revenant was going to win because it won a lot of other awards. The same happened with, I can't remember which one, Three Billboards maybe, and another one, I think. They kind of like going against the grain a bit.
Do you apply any kind of, when you're betting on Oscar stuff, are you also trying to apply some sort of rule to it, or are you just having a bit of fun?
I try to apply a bit of a rule, trying to see what kind of thing the Oscar body like, and what kind of thing. I knew The Revenant was definitely not going to win because it was a divisive win. What won that year? Was it Moonlight?
I don't think that was that year, was it?
Or Spotlight?
I think it may have been Spotlight.
One of those, yeah. There were a few where it was quite obviously not going to be that because it was too divisive a film, and The Revenant is too divisive. And actually, the Oscar voting system is, it's a preferential vote. People don't know this, that everyone ranks their lists, and then it's like, what do you call it, alternative vote. So ones which are very divisive get knocked off, and the one which is everyone's second favorite film is the most likely to win, probably.
Yes, yeah. There's also a thing, isn't there, where you're not supposed to have two actors or actresses from the same film in the category, because otherwise they tend to cancel.
They're all very strategic about that, so they push people for different categories.
It is interesting. Yeah. So now you're not rusty at poker anymore.
Yeah.
Does it now feel quite, this is doable, I can make money, I'll be fine doing this for...
Yeah, it feels quite good because I basically didn't do much poker for the last 3 years while I was doing... I was focusing mostly on comedy. I just moved to London about 4 years ago and I said, I'll focus on comedy for now, I'll put poker to the back burner. And it was just too busy to play poker. So that's why I got rusty, because I was playing a bit every few months, but not really getting into it.
God, it's funny. So then, by that reckoning, is the amount of money you earn based on how much nerve you have in putting money in?
Sort of, yeah. You do. There is a lot of nerve. You do have to take a lot of risks. It's like people who are too conservative, you have to enter that part of you which is willing to lose a lot, and people who are too conservative don't make as much as people who take the bigger risks.
And you have a confidence that you will be all right in the end. You're like, it'll be all right in the end. I might lose it now, but I'll get it back.
Yeah. On every given day, the graph could be really up and down. But as long as you zoom out and then it is slightly going upwards. So it could be going up and down, but if it's slightly going upwards, then
then that's
it's the same as the stock market. It's the exact... So it's the exact same thing. Stock market is essentially the same as poker. They have the exact same thing. So on any given day, the stock market could go down a bit, but you can't worry about that. On any given day, you could lose like a few hundred dollars, but as long as end of the month you're up, you're up. That's fine.
So I'm just looking at your list of your favourite films, and you've got I've seen like most of those in the last couple of weeks. Well, Princess Bride, Back to the Future, and Galaxy Quest. I've watched all three of those within the last.
Really? Week. What made you watch Galaxy Quest? Because I come back to that every couple of years, and it's just fun.
I think it's fantastic. Well, why did I watch Galaxy Quest? I watched Galaxy Quest, I think, because I was watching it with over the internet with a friend who hadn't seen it before.
Yeah, I did that as well.
She'd just seen Alien and Aliens.
Oh, yeah.
And I was Sigourney Weaver's incredible in Galaxy Quest as well. And it was like a Saturday afternoon, so it's like kind of like a Saturday afternoon film. Yeah, it's Galaxy Quest is brilliant.
Yeah. Have you seen it, Nat?
I've seen it, yeah. I've never liked it as much as other people seem to. But yeah. I feel like I'm missing something.
Go on.
Well, I just think it's got one of the best Alan Rickman performances.
Oh, yeah. His character is incredible.
I always think of Alan Rickman as quite a serious actor, and then, but I love him. I loved him. And then it was like, when you see him in something like Galaxy Quest, it always makes me happy to know that he thought Die Hard was a really great roller coaster movie, and he was really proud of Die Hard.
Yeah.
And I always and the fact that he's turned up and he's having so much fun in Galaxy Quest, and you know, it's brilliant. Tim Allen's great. Yeah.
I think that is it. The people are just having fun in it. They're not looking down on it, and they're great actors. It's a great cast, and I think. I like it because it's not like the best movie ever, but it's like representative of a time where you could have kind of movies like that, which are you can't really have a movie like Galaxy Quest now. There'd be no way they release a movie like that now. It's kind of in this middle where it's both fun, but it does take the concept quite seriously. But it is a ridiculous high concept, but it takes it seriously. It takes the sci-fi seriously. It takes the comedy seriously, and you don't really have that. You don't really have those movies.
It's like a mid-level budget as well.
Yeah,
and it's sort of about a specific. It's about Star Trek fans basically, and fan conventions.
Yes.
So you could do sort of like maybe like a Marvel sort of thing and make it about Comic-Con or something like that. But. Yeah, it's really... And out of those films, you know, like Three Amigos, Tropic Thunder, A Bug's Life, and Galaxy Quest, where you go kind of like, you recruit a bunch of people that are pretending to be a thing, and then they end up having to do it for real. it's sort of like, it's the same as those films, but but I think out of those, like, it probably does it almost the best. As much as I love Three Amigos, I think Galaxy Quest is kind of a... So it was originally meant to be directed by Harold Ramis.
Was it?
I can't remember who he wanted to be the lead, but I think it might have been someone like Steve Martin.
Right.
And they said, like, well, we're going to get Tim Allen. And Harold Ramis was just like, I have absolutely no idea how to make Tim Allen work in this role. So he left the project and someone else came
in. Allen's great in it. He's great.
Tim Allen's, he's basically live action Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah. Know? And he channels the like kind of William Shatner parody very well. Like he doesn't overdo it. But he is kind of a version of William Shatner.
Yeah, it's without doing an impression or I think he's perfect in it. And also, like, all of that baggage that he brings from actually just being Tim Allen.
Yeah.
coming along and being in this film. And he's acting, you know, it's the guy from Home Improvement that's acting opposite Sigourney Weaver and fucking Alan Rickman. And it's kind of like, and he's the star.
Yeah.
And so they all bring all of this, you know, you've got Sigourney Weaver, who's possibly one of the most famous and iconic science fiction stars of all time. And she was in Ghostbusters, right? Yeah. And you've got Sigourney Weaver, and then you've got Alan Rickman, who's like this serious thespian, and you're relegating her to kind of like the one that has to wear a push-up bra and have like blonde hair, and he's kind of like got this fucking ridiculous headpiece on the entire film. And then you've
even
got
when
Tim
he's
Allen,
in the kitchen.
you've got Tim Allen as like the action hero lead, and it's kind of like all of that feeds into why the film is sort of like successful as well. Oh, yeah, Harold Ramis wanted Alec Baldwin to be.
Baldwin, okay, interesting.
And there's also, so when's the last time you saw it, Ken?
Like a few weeks ago, yeah. I watched it with a friend who's never seen it. My two friends.
You know the bit when they go on the deck where they've got all of like the crushers?
Oh, the crushers, yeah.
And so there's a bit, and so you see it, and it's really complicated.
Yeah.
And then Sigourney Weaver goes, well, screw that. Right? If you look at her mouth, she's actually saying, well, fuck that. Right? And then at the last minute, they said, we're going to make it into a kids' film. So they took out all of the swearing and she had to recap it. But you can, she's saying, fuck that.
I didn't notice that.
Her mouth actually saying it. And the other thing was that the company that made it, they thought it was going to be a fake. They didn't think it was going to be very good. Mm. They didn't get it. So they didn't market it. And then when it came out, it was a massive flop because nobody knew about it.
Yeah,
and then later on, the marketing team apologised to the film, and said, "Sorry, we didn't market it. It was our fault."
They always do that.
It's crazy, but it lives on in our hearts. I think it's a great film.
Yeah,
you've also got amongst your favourite things, Ken, Star Trek: Next Generation.
Yeah, I've been rewatching.
I know, I was just going to say, we're talking about Galaxy Quest. Do you only like Star Trek: Next Generation?
No, I put that down because I think I've been rewatching it over the last. It's on Netflix. I've rewatched some random episodes. I like Star Trek Deep Space Nine quite a lot. Deep Space Nine, okay. I think it's really good. And I'm not actually a big fan of the original series. It's a bit too old for me, I think. But
sure.
It's kind of nice.
I think we're talking about this. I always think that Star Trek fans seem to like
one
Star Trek The Next Generation now more than they like the regular...
Well, I grew up... When I was like 10 to 15, Star Trek Next Generation was on every day when you get home from school and you just watch it, like 5 p.m. or whatever, Sky One, just watch an episode and they're just, yeah, it's great. I'm in that generation.
The next generation.
Are you a Star Trek fan? Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, I'm not hardcore. I don't go to the conventions, but I watched a lot of it. I've seen probably every episode, or at least most episodes. And I watched
every series?
Not every series. Not like Enterprise. I don't watch every episode of Enterprise.
Which is weird, because that was Scott Bakula, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I love him. And
he's great. Quantum Leap.
The fact that you got another series after Quantum Leap was kind of like a real victory. And then it's kind of like Enterprise came out and I just never watched it.
It's crap. It was bad. It was just bad. They kind of forgot what was good about Star Trek. I saw a great video about it and how the guy in charge at that point just wanted sex and violence and didn't really know what Star Trek was anymore.
Have you seen Star Trek Picard?
I have. Didn't like it.
It's terrible.
Yeah, bad. Really weird. It's just not at all the same.
Well, just basically, Patrick Stewart didn't want to make it.
Yeah, you can tell.
they said, well, what if we give you creative control?
Yeah.
And he said, sure. And then he sort of made it, he said, I'm going to make it all about Trump and Brexit. And they were like, what?
Very odd. It's very un-Star Trek.
Well, there's swearing in it as well.
Yeah, and it's very weird.
It's just kind of like, I don't want to watch Star Trek and have a load of swearing in it, which is ironic because I swear so much. But like, they even mentioned in one of the Star Trek films, Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home.
Oh, yeah.
The future, they've sort of like phased swearing out.
Yeah. And yeah, no Spock doesn't know how to swear.
And then you've got Star Trek Picard when they're all like saying, the fucking arrogance of the fucking dude. And it's just like, you go, it just looked weird.
Yeah.
And I think Patrick Stewart is very good in the role.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that he should be.
No.
Patrick Stewart had the same thing in the film Logan, where in that film it was R-rated. So it was like an X-Men film where they're suddenly allowed to swear anymore for the first time. So you have that scene where Patrick Stewart out of nowhere just goes, and I'm fucking 90. Out of nowhere, and you go, blimey, that's come out of nowhere.
That is fun.
It is fun. It's fun to see people swearing.
Patrick Stewart is a great... It's such an interesting that he did that. Like, The Next Generation. Like, he's just... And he just gives it... Well, rewatching it now as an adult, you realize, like, knowing a bit about acting, oh, he's actually just doing really good acting all the time. He's just very good in this role.
Hmm. I guess hello, go on.
But also, it made him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was in sort of like some BBC Shakespeare adaptations. Yeah.
He was a Shakespeare guy.
And then all of a sudden, he's in Star Trek, and it's just like, fine, I'm going to do that until the fucking wheels come off. It's like, yeah. And then through that.
And X-Men. It's just like.
He got X-Men. I mean, he should have been Mr. Freeze in a better Batman novel.
Yeah. Now that's cast Austrian bodybuilder Arnold Schwarzenegger instead.
It's mental, because you just like go, so we're doing Mr. Freeze, and you go, well, Patrick Stewart looks like Mr. Freeze.
He's a bald English man.
Put glasses on him and put him in like a cryo suit, and then, yeah, it's Mr. Freeze. Absolutely perfect. Brilliant. That's that sorted.
But that Arnold was it, wasn't it? That was
Arnold
it.
Arnold Schwarzenegger? What? It's crazy. What did you say, Nat?
I was just saying that's who it was for so long, wasn't it, in people's mind. I think in those 90s Batman films, they were exactly like, the person cast was often exactly who you had in your head until the Mr. Freeze one.
I don't know. I think everyone wanted Robin Williams to be the Riddler.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but he was, again, wasn't he? He was, like, the person who was going to do it, and then he didn't sign on or spent too long, I mean, an hour and about whether he wanted to do it.
Mm. I mean, I hate those films.
Joel Schumacher. The Joel Schumacher Batmans.
Well, he just died, didn't he? Joel Schumacher died, what, like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
I mean, but he made some amazing films.
Yeah, he made Falling Down.
He's not a bad director. Lost Boy.
Phone Booth.
Flatliners.
Yeah.
Phone Booth, yeah. I mean, he's not
a Lost Boys.
Yeah, he's got a good resume. It's just like everyone who goes into a superhero movie who hasn't done that kind of thing just can really, it can go any way. It can go any way.
Yeah, but also like Batman Returns was so dark that Matt Donald's were furious with Warner Brothers because it was such a dark film. You know, it's got like the penguin like biting someone's nose and blood squirts out.
Yeah, it's very odd.
Again, there's all this like black and green bile that's coming out of his mouth.
I watched that when I was 8 or something. I was like, oh, what the hell is this?
I still think it's sort of like a kid's film. I still enjoyed it as a kid. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But like when you watch it through, it's probably worse as an adult. You watch it.
It is. I watched it last year or this year, and it's sort of extraordinary some of the stuff it gets away with.
He sets the bed on fire.
Pushes her out the window, and then she's just lying there, and all the cats appear.
Danny DeVito says to Catwoman, just the pussy I was looking for. It's all that kind of all the way through. It's all just that kind of, oi, 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 for essentially a kid's movie. The jokes are kind of just dirty.
So they had a Happy Meal deal with McDonald's, where they were trying to shift like, these little Catwoman toys and penguin toys. And it's just like, kids aren't allowed to see the fucking film. Do you know what I mean? It's so violent and there's murders in it and it's just like, oh, right, okay. So when Joel Schumacher came along, they said, whatever you do, don't do what Tim Burton did. So he made it sort of like family-friendly.
He also made it trippy as hell.
When it was a success, when Batman Forever was a success, they said about, like, Batman and Robin, oh, you can pretty much do what you like because you've just proven yourself. No, they were just like, right, we made loads of money on Batman Forever, so now we just want to do toys. And so Batman and Robin is basically as a toy advert.
Yeah.
which is the... I mean, it tries so hard to be as inoffensive...
Yeah.
As part. There's even a line in it where Arnold Schwarzenegger says, kill the heroes! And you go, that's a bit on the nose. Don't you know, do you know what I mean?
Kill the heroes!
It's so bad. What killed the dinosaur? The Ice Age!
And they throw everything into it. They got Bane, Batgirl, they got Poison Ivy. It's like everyone's in it. They just throw everything in.
Such an absolute pile of shit. But so you also right. So Back to the Future, right? I watched Back to the Future recently. Yeah. That I think that is one of the all-time out of like a handful. I think it is a perfect film.
Me too.
We're in the same. But it's just so tight. Like every moment in it is like perfectly structured and like builds into it.
Every moment pays off.
Yeah.
Everything from the first half gets paid off in the second half. It's just so tight. There's nothing wasted in that film.
Yeah.
And it's but I watched it 2 weeks ago and I hadn't seen it in a while. But I have seen it sort of like, I see it once every 4 years or something
right,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I watched it, I watched it 2 weeks ago. And I don't know whether it's because of like the political environment that we're living in. It is quite weird sort of like watching films that you've sort of grown up with and then watching them now that it's been sort of like a shift in society.
Yes.
But Back to the Future, I mean, this is the first time I've watched it where I've really considered the fact that the main plot of it is his mum is trying to fuck him.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's like there's no avoiding it. That's the main plot.
Yeah,
his mum
yeah.
is trying to fuck him.
It is odd. It's like, oh, that's just in a kid, pretty kid-friendly like blockbuster movie. Yeah, that's just there.
And then in order to sort of win over... get George McFly to go out with Lorraine, he's going to sexually assault his own mum in a car.
That is pretty fucked up, yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's
the
bit where you kind of go, yeah, that is a bit...
I'm not like saying there's anything wrong with Back to the Future, right? I can deal with it. I watched the film. I'm an intelligent person. I can contextualise things. It's fine. But it was the first time I watched it and went, she really wants to fuck him.
Yeah.
That's sort of... And she's sort of undressed him in her bed. You don't know how much she's seen.
Yeah.
Do you think there's meant to be an element to it as well? That when he sees his own mum, Lorraine, as a young person, that the audience, and he's your audience identifier figure, you're meant to go, oh, she looks all right. Like, when you see her first young, I think you're meant to go, wow.
Yeah, I do think that. Yeah, I think there is that moment.
He's the audience, but he's also her son. So he's kind of, on one hand, you're seeing her as he's seeing her, and going, oh, she looks good.
They should be together. Like George McFly is he's a peeping Tom. He's a pervert. George McFly is not a hero. George McFly is a pervert.
He's an incel. He's a complete original incel.
Like, Martin McFly is outgoing, adventurous, brave, you know, he's creative.
Got
he's
banned. Brilliant.
Everyone wants to be Martin McFly. No one wants to be George McFly. It's just, and you go like, oh, it's because he's a nerd and he's been, you know, been bullied. No, he's a pervert. He's spying on women getting changed at the beginning of the film. That's why he falls out of a tree. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, he's like an awful, he's a bad man, George McFly is. If I was Marty McFly and I travelled back in time and Leah Thompson from 1985 was my mum, I'd have sex with her. Absolutely. Not a doubt in my mind. I'd take extra plutonium with me as well so that I could go back and forth.
Make a good night, sweetheart.
Make a weekend of it. Be like good night, sweetheart. instead of bigamy, he's having sex with his much younger mum.
Good night, sweetheart, but we're incest.
Just throw that in.
Absolutely disgusting. And Princess Bride.
Yes.
I saw that maybe last week.
You're a fan?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, it's my... Well, 2 days ago, I watched Stand By Me.
I've not seen that.
Oh, God, I forgot, like, how emotional Stand By Me is, but I don't think I've seen Stand By Me in 20 years, and I watched it. I'm so old now that you can say I hadn't seen it in 20 years.
I cried from
beginning to end. I just thought it was absolutely devastating. The reason I mentioned Stand By Me is because it's Rob Reiner.
Oh, yeah.
And Rob Reiner directed Princess Bride, Spinal Tap.
A good 80s.
I think he's better than Spielberg. I think Rob Reiner just made films that were absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Spielberg's got a specific thing, right? But
I feel like I'm being manipulated by Spielberg.
I mean, yeah, he is a master manipulator. That is basically what it is. Like, he is a master manipulator.
But you compare something like Stand By Me with The Goonies.
Right.
And it's sort of like, I mean, Spielberg only produced it, but you can kind of like, you can feel him all over the
game. Yeah, well, who was it? Was it Chris Columbus or one of those?
Richard Donner.
It was Richard Donner, yeah.
But it's basically, it's the same film, isn't it? Stand By Me and the Goonies.
Right,
but one
right.
of them is kind of like, it's like, when it was the Goonies, it was just kind of like, when I was little, I didn't want to be another kid that was going on an exciting adventure. I wanted to be Indiana Jones.
Right, yeah.
I didn't want to be some kids pretending to be Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Which is what the Goonies is to me.
Yeah.
But when you look at Stand By Me, you go, that's absolutely, that is an incredible movie.
Devastating.
You should go and watch it. Go and watch it, Ken.
I've seen bits of it.
Do you know what? Not... That's my gift to you today.
Okay, I should go watch it.
Yeah, it's my gift. It's my gift to you. You go and watch Stand By Me.
Thank you.
Princess Bride, what Stand By Me is by the same guy.
Yeah.
right, okay, we are running out of time. I'm really sorry, Ken. Thank you for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
We're going to play a game, all right?
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty high stakes. I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel.
Oh, yeah.
It's the game, Ken. It's called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the previous person based entirely on my own opinion. So you earn points if you guess my opinion.
Okay. I'm trying to think.
Starting with Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
Is Catherine Zeta-Jones better or worse than Uma Thurman?
Worse.
I would say worse.
Worse, correct.
Yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones, better or worse than Catherine Zeta-Jones?
Better.
Better, yes. Jamie Lee Curtis, better or worse than Tommy Lee Jones?
Better.
Ooh, I don't know.
Richard Curtis, better or worse than Jamie Lee Curtis?
Oh, worse. Gotta be worse.
Richard Gere, better or worse than Richard Curtis?
Better.
Ooh, I think I'd go worse.
Ooh.
I don't really like Gere. Got no time for Gere.
Oh, my God! You're not meant to like him!
Richard Dreyfuss, I suppose. Richard Dreyfuss, better or worse than Richard Gere?
Better.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, better or worse than Richard Dreyfuss?
Better.
Julia Stiles, better or worse than Julia Louis-Dreyfus?
Worse.
Julia Roberts, better or worse than Julia Stiles?
Better.
Yeah! I think that's a 9.
It's a 9. I think it's a 9. But that's only because you... I mean, that's your fault, Nat.
Who likes Richard Curtis?
Is better than Richard Gere. That's better. You scored a 9, which means you're not as good as Jen Brister and Jason Manford with 10, but you are as good as Harry Hill and Luke Morley with 9. And you're better than Susie Dent's Magical Bones, Henry Normal and Johnny Vegas. So you absolutely thrashed it. You're not quite at the top of the leaderboard, but you're doing pretty well.
Amazing.
Well, Ken, welcome to the clubhouse. that's how I'm gonna sign out all this.
now on. Great. It's not creepy as hell.
Good. Well, I'm glad. I didn't think it did come across as creepy. I thought just balanced that just right. We're gonna say goodbye to you now, Ken, but don't actually leave. Because we need to take a photo with you at the end.
Good.
But I've been Nick Helm.
I've been Nathaniel Metcalf.
And this has been... Say your name, Ken.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the name of the show or you had some sting. Ken Chang.
Slick as fuck. So keep that fan mail coming in. And we won't see you, but you'll be listening to it. Well, I hope you'll come back. Listen to us again. First rule of fan club, tell your friends. Second rule of fan club, please tell your friends.
Come back.
We'll see you next week. Bye. Thank you very much. Goodbye. We'll be right back.